Blog Talk Radio.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body.
This is Dr. Jennifer Daniels, and you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Blake Radio channel, Rainbow Soul at BlakeRadio.com. And it is Tuesday, May 13th, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And today's topic is, are you a racist? Could your racism be making you an easy mark for consumption of deadly care by the incredibly savvy marketers? So this is not about black or white or anything like that. What it's really about is the race-baiting marketing tactics used to get people, based on their personal racial biases, to consume care that is not only deadly, there's no chance whatever of benefiting them. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to talk about exactly what's going on in medical marketing, how racism is being exploited, and how everybody, whether you're black, white, brown, green, or gray, is being seduced into submitting to deadly therapy, being seduced into becoming one of the 860,000 Americans every year who are murdered at the hands of the medical system. So I'm going to talk about my experiences really starting in medical school, because that's when it's like a child at the age of three. When you see something for the first time, you say, man, this doesn't add up. This is like, there's something wrong here. And of course, just like a three-year-old child, as a medical student seeing this for the first time, all I knew was something was wrong. I couldn't put my finger on it, but something was wrong. So we have to talk, before we talk about that, we have to talk about calling in. Phone number is 914-338-0695. You can call that number for questions. We take in questions the second half of the hour. And we have a very nice chat room going, and it's at healingwithdrdaniels.chatango.com. Okay. So, first of all, we have to talk about what racism is, because if you don't know what racism is, we can't get some agreement on this, then it's really tough to talk about. So, what is racism? For this, I decided that I would rely on the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. And let's see what Merriam-Webster has to say about racism. Now, Merriam-Webster had a lot to say about racism. I'm just going to take out a little bit. So, racism is the ideology that humans are divided into separate and exclusive biological entities called races. So first you have to have the belief that there are separate human races. That's number one. Then you have to believe there's a causal link between inherited physical traits, namely skin color, in this case, and behavioral features. Those are the two things you have to believe. And a third thing it helps to believe is that some races are inherently superior to others. But for the purposes of today's program, all you need to believe is that some races are different from others. The belief of superiority or not superiority is actually not relevant, because the marketers are very savvy, and they have got that one covered, I'm telling you. All you have to believe is that there are separate races, and there's a causal link between inherited physical trait, we're talking skin color this time, and behavioral features. If you believe those two things, they got you, and you are at serious danger of becoming one of the 860,000 Americans every year who walk into the meat grinder called medical care. Okay, so let's talk about the Civil Rights Movement. If you understand the Civil Rights Movement, that helps a lot too. The Civil Rights Movement, if you want to just put it in general terms, was the idea that certain citizens in the United States needed to have more rights as civilians. Unfortunately, the Civil Rights Movement was taken over by the spin doctors. And the only idea that was covered or even addressed by the Civil Rights Movement was racism against others, or against other races. This was condemned. The problem was, what about racist views toward yourself? What about racist views toward your own personal race? What about feeling that you are good or bad because of your race? This was not even addressed by the Civil Rights Movement. But this is just as racist, and unfortunately, this is even more dangerous. It's absolutely deadly, because if you have a racist belief about the race that you belong to, that racist belief can be and is being exploited by the marketers to convince you to participate in your own murder. So we're going to talk about what's happening here. Let's talk about heart disease. Was first marketed, and this is, I came on the tail end of this marketing campaign, it was a disease of white male executives who had high-stress jobs and a type A personality. Most of you who are listening and you're over 40, you might remember this. Most of you who are over 60, you definitely remember this. So this marketing tactic, a rallying cry, we've got to do something about heart disease. These white male executives have a high-stress job, a type A personality. And so what this did was it played to the vanity of white males. And so every white male then felt that he would want to subject himself to the highly invasive and unreliable and even deadly tests surrounding heart disease, and further, the unneeded but equally deadly therapies recommended as part of the evaluation. And if you'll recall, anyone's taken a stress test, they always make you sign this thing saying, you know, you're going to, you, the stress test could induce a heart attack and you could drop dead. Well, wait a minute. I don't care if you had severe heart disease. At the point at which you walked into the doctor's office, it's reasonable to believe you're probably going to live another 2 or 3 days. So how can you possibly justify taking a test that's deadly to uncover a situation that's obviously not deadly? We know it's not deadly because you walk into the doctor's office. Now, further research reveal that the cardiac stress test, the EKG, as reliable predictive indicators of heart disease are absolutely, totally, and completely unreliable. And by the way, that's what we were using back in the 80s when I walked in on this really breathtaking scam. And so I was in medical school at the time that I became aware of this, and we took care of people who did not have a choice. We took care of people who were on Medicaid and would come to clinics because that's really the only way they could get medical care. And I thought that surely the medical school was going to teach me the real stuff that works, because I did not see any of these patients getting better, even though they got exactly what the textbook said they were supposed to get. So I thought they were going to tell me the real stuff, the stuff that you would share with your family or friends and paying clients. So during the course of medical school, many of you know, I took a year off and went to business school. Well, when I went to business school, I made friends with a doctor who exclusively cared for the wealthy. That's it. That's what he did. One day, he told me to meet him in his office. Whoa. Now, this office, I have to tell you, the facility of the medical school, which is a not-for-profit facility, okay? All right. Well, all I can say is, wow. It looked like posh executive suite. And I said, what happens here? What kind of patients come here? So he told me, oh, wealthy executives come here, you know, to get their annual exams for $900. Now, this is 1982. $900 in 1982 was a lot of money. I said, well, what do you do for $900? He said, oh, we do EKGs and stress tests and sometimes we prescribe medications. I said, well, anything else? He said, well, we do the same stuff that you learn in medical school. Well, I just about fell over. the same painful, ineffective stuff we were doing for the welfare patients in the clinics is what the wealthy were getting. Murder with the amenities. Oh, my God. So the tender age of 24, I was just stunned. I was just stunned. I was flabbergasted at this level of, I guess you could say, deception. And really the only comfort I could give to myself was that when I got to be a doctor, at least I wouldn't have to stoop to this. So there's another point here, though. The racial positioning of heart disease as afflicting white male wealthy, read wealthy double underline, the first thing it did was targeted a segment of the population most able to pay for services on a whim and played, again, to their vanity and to their racism. And if a person did not believe that white skin conferred any qualities other than skin color, they would look at this advertisement of white males having this particular affliction as being, well, preposterous. And they wouldn't even respond to that advertising ploy. But unfortunately, there were enough white males in the country who took a bite for this, and the deluxe executive clinic was really thriving, as a matter of fact. Now, the second factor that this marketing ploy did was that people who were not white male felt deprived. And they developed a desire for this exclusive label and even this disease that was associated with being wealthy and powerful. So the racial positioning played on the racist beliefs of the whole culture. And it led everyone who could possibly afford it to submit to the deadly and ineffective therapy. So the marketers didn't stop there. So once they went after the white male executives, all of a sudden in the 80s, heart disease was a disease, a hidden disease in women. Women were underdiagnosed in the emergency room for heart disease. Women needed to get screened for heart disease. Now, women, again, this is sexism. Women took it as a sign of equality to have a diagnosis of heart disease, or at least a barrage of tests that could detect it. And so they then took up the banner of gender equality. And what did this do for women? Unfortunately, it was not good. What happened was, actually in the mid-90s, I was asked to research and to do a lecture on heart disease and women and how it was underdiagnosed, and really just to talk about the whole victimhood thing, about how women were being exploited and ignored because they didn't get adequate health care. All right. So naturally, I figured I should at least go to the library, look this up. Well, fortunately, the VA hospital, incredible database they have, did some research on this matter. But the VA hospital determined, right about 1994, they took a look at all the women who came into the emergency room where the diagnosis of heart disease was missed. And later it was revealed maybe during hospitalization or a week down the road, whatever. And what they found was the women who did not get treated, did not get the standard of care for heart disease, had a better survival than the ones who were diagnosed and who did get treated for heart disease. Well, I read that and I just said, well, how can I give this kind of talk about women needing to get diagnosed for heart disease? Well, obviously, this study done by the Veterans Hospital was not widely publicized, and the publicist, whoever does the information segments on the 6 o'clock news, took a different tact. So women's sexist beliefs led them down this heart disease path of death and destruction, really. Very unfortunate. But they didn't stop there. They did not stop there. I mean, when you're on a roll, you're on a roll. From the mid to late 90s, heart disease became a disease of Joe Sixpack. Redneck, high cholesterol, high meat diet, and oh my God, Joe Sixpack. He was the reason the whole country was sick. If only he would get checked. If only he would get his cholesterol checked. If only he would take his cholesterol pills. I was floored when these white males between the ages of 30 and 50 showed up at my office. This is really a shock, right? Because it's a black doctor, black inner city area, you know, a lot of drug dealing, whatever. I mean, I cleaned up the neighborhood. We'd shut down the major drug dens. So I guess maybe they thought it was safe to come. But they came, and I was surprised. And so they gave me they repeated the whole TV commercial a bit by bit. I mean, I was almost convinced. I said, look, heart disease is just beriberi. What's beriberi? Beriberi is a B vitamin deficiency. I mean, if you distill it down to its lowest level, this would be vitamin deficiency. So here's what you do. I've done some research showing that if you take a full milligram of folic acid, then your chances of a heart attack are just about zero. So why don't you take the folic acid? It's a heck of a lot cheaper. I don't need to stab your veins to check for cholesterol, and you can just have a good life. Would you believe that there are men who would not accept that? They wanted a cholesterol test anyway? Oh, my God. So I kind of, said, okay, if you're going to take a cholesterol medicine, fine, but at least take the B vitamins. And literally, it was a status thing. These white men, black men too, wanted to be good Americans, get their cholesterol checked, and do what they could to lower the heart disease death toll in the United States. I mean, it's like a numbers game kind of thing. And they wanted to help the United States get a better score. Unfortunately, if you listen to my shows, taking a cholesterol pill a day is not exactly a health move. And so in the late 90s, we got Joe Sixpack. Joe Sixpack came into the fold, taking his cholesterol medications, getting his tests done. And then, of course, there's this big cry that poor Joe Sixpack, who had these manual labor jobs that didn't carry health insurance, what Joe Sixpack really needed was health insurance. Now, if Joe Sixpack knew his problem was beriberi and all it took was a $3 a month worth of folic acid, he would probably say, I don't want health insurance, give me the folic acid. But, again, no one told Joe Sixpack. So, again, that was such a good campaign, and they got health insurance slapped on to every human being whose employer would tolerate it. Then they turned their attention to blacks. Now, health disease, if you've been following the news, heart disease is now a disease of poor blacks who are stressed by their low socioeconomic status, and because of this, they suffer hypertension and heart disease. And now we have to make sure every impoverished black person is fully diagnosed and medicated for heart disease. What's this about? Well, this is about now that we have universal coverage where every human being is a dollar bill. In other words, what they can do is snatch somebody up off the street. When I say they, I mean hospitals, insurance companies, drug companies, snatch them up off the street, slap them on some expensive medication, and that person has got to either pay out of pocket or get some health insurance. And that's really unfortunate. And so this is really the marketing cycle. Now, a true disease has biological markers, right? So true disease, let's just say heart disease, has a biological marker. Maybe it's an abnormal EKG. Maybe it's a blood test or whatever. But it does not change its demographics. Some diseases are carried by bad water, some by bad food, but there's different characteristics. So when you have a disease that affects wealthy white men, then middle-class white women, then poor white men, and then poor blacks, well, that's not a disease. That's an economic marketing opportunity is what it is. And so this is the heart disease pattern. And believe it or not, what got me to do this, probably what got me to do this show tonight, is there are people in the medical community who are saying, hey, wait, we were not born yesterday. How is it that heart disease was an affliction of wealthy white men in the 90s or the late 80s, mid-80s, and now it's an affliction of poor blacks? What's up with that? So if it truly is a disease, and if the disease is a racial disease, let's just say it, some reason it seems to segregate by race, let's just say, then it would be a white male disease. At no point would it ever become a black disease if really it's a racial disease, a disease confined to one race or another. So obviously, this disease has nothing to do with race, number one, but marketing does. And this is simply nothing but massive exploitation of people's internal racism, their belief that races even exist. And I would say for the sake of your health, you should even just banish that belief that there are different races, because this is what the marketers are playing on, is the belief an individual has that there's a difference, biological difference, medical or health difference between people of different skin colors. And I'll just tell you a little joke. It would be a joke if it didn't really happen. Two doctors were talking. I was just a medical student trying to learn something. And so they had a Hispanic patient. Now, listeners, might not understand. A Hispanic person has an intermediate skin color. So this person, depending on how you slice it, maybe they're white, maybe they're black, maybe they're neither, whatever. So one doctor is saying, well, I don't really know what the diagnosis is here. I mean, if the person was white, why would we just say he had a little bit of stress or anxiety? But if he's black, we'd say he's a down-and-out drunk. But the person's Hispanic, what do I do? What's the diagnosis? So the second doctor said, and this just about really floored me, he said, well, which box did he check when he came in? Did he check the box that he was Hispanic white or he was Hispanic black? And literally, they went with that diagnosis that he was. I forget what he was. Hopefully he checked the Hispanic white box. Those of you who are Hispanics, whenever you go to the hospital, check the Hispanic white box. You'll probably live a little longer. And I was just shocked. I mean, I looked at this guy. He was obviously, his skin was not white. It was a brownish color. And, you know, there were many blacks that had the same color skin. But this whole thing about race has no place in medicine. You know, they transplant organs from black people into white people, and they seem to do just fine with it. So, but what I'm putting out here is how this racism is used to exploit individuals and to make them submit to care that, you know, anyone would just say, well, that's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. Now, I have to tell you what happened when I first opened my medical practice. When I first opened my medical practice, this lady came in. She was white, and she was just an adorable little grandmother type, and she went to the front desk, who was my mother, the front desk person, and she said, excuse me, does Dr. Daniels treat white people? Did they teach her white medicine in medical school and black medicine? And so somehow my brother heard about this, and he was absolutely enraged. And so Mom told me what she had said. I said, Mom, tell her that, yes, I learned the white medicine too. And so Mom told her that I did learn the white medicine while I was in medical school, and she was totally relieved. And actually, she became an incredible support for the practice, a wonderful patient. She volunteered to help do things around the practice, invited my family to her house, everything, and I really helped her family quite a bit with their health issues. So this is really a seriously ingrained belief. Now, in her defense, she was 70 years old back in 1990-something, and so that means that she was around during the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and they might have had a different care that they gave to whites and to blacks. But when I went to medical school in the 80s, they found it was so profitable to give the same ineffective and dangerous care to both that that's what they were doing when I went to medical school in 79 to 83. So that is the heart disease, but it didn't stop there. It was so good that they went on and they did asthma. Now, I'll have to tell you, my experience is that I grew up in an inner city neighborhood, all black neighborhood, at least from the age of, 7 years old onwards, all black neighborhood. And pretty much everybody's house had a few roaches. And somebody's house, if their mother was a particularly poor housekeeper, had lots of roaches. And we didn't bother anybody. And nobody had any breathing problems. I mean, none. No one had any breathing issues whatever. And it wasn't until I was in 7th grade, I guess I was 13 or 14 years old, that I actually met somebody who had a breathing problem. And, of course, the person was white. And they explained to me all about their breathing problem. I said, well, that's interesting. I'd never heard of such a thing. So I never saw another person who had a breathing problem until I got to medical school. I saw a patient in medical school who had a breathing problem. So this is what we were told in medical school. In medical school, we were told, this is 1980-something, that's early 80s, that asthma was the disease of white, middle-class, hysterical girls who were emotionally high-strung, and they would have an emotional attack over issues, like, let's say, if a middle-class white girl was upset, then she would have an asthma attack because she was upset. And I thought that was interesting. And that was the story for a while, from, I would say, 1980 to about 1990-ish. And then around 1992, all these studies came out showing that the new asthma was now defined as inner-city child who is having asthma due to roach dander. Yes, roach dander. So I found this absolutely preposterous, because there was absolutely no breathing problems among the hundreds of people I knew who grew up around roaches. And why all of a sudden in 1990s was asthma a disease of poor blacks exposed to roach dander? Now, what happened in 1990 that didn't happen in 1970, or late 1970s, early 80s? Well, in the 80s, again, the target market was, again, middle class, read employed, parents employed, middle class, parents employed, white hysterical girls. Now, hysterical is very important because, of course, most teenagers, if you ask your parents, they'll tell you the teenager is hysterical. But the point is, it had to be the girls they would target because the person making the judgment would be the parent. So in other words, it would have been a bit much to insult the parent directly. And so if you have a situation where the person receiving the care is not the one making the decisions, then it's really easy to make these negative judgments like this. Your chat has been closed because you have been idle. Reconnect. So it's easy to impugn or make negative accusations in a disease description if the person paying for the care is not the same person you're accusing. So in this case, white, middle-class, hysterical girls, the target is the parent. You're really trying to get the parent to believe that their daughter has a problem. And the description hysterical girl will have the parents of every single 12 to 16-year-old bringing the girl in to see if it's asthma. And so this is a very profitable marketing tactic, and it worked pretty well. Now, another thing in medical school that I found very actually troubling, I didn't know any middle-class white hysterical girls, so I figured, well, I guess this is what they're teaching us in medical school, and I'm sure that the white kids in medical school who hadn't met any blacks that fit the description they were describing in black patients were probably thinking, well, glad they're teaching me this. I'd never seen this. I would never have known this. And so, but they went on to say this, that this disease called asthma was harmless and resulted in absolutely no deaths until they started treating it with drugs. Then people started dying of asthma. And because of this, we have to continue to treat with drugs because we now know it's a deadly disease. And, of course, I totally missed the point. And I said, well, excuse me, if it wasn't deadly before the drugs, why don't we just stop the drugs and then the deaths from asthma would go away? I said, Dr. Daniels, I don't think you understand. So maybe I didn't understand. So I had to concede that because I just didn't have the perspective to have any big picture. And so, again, this is targeted against the middle class, which means employed people. And so once that employed market was saturated, this is probably 10 years or so, they came out with a new asthmatic defined as a poor inner-city child. This, of course, was 100% financed because by now Medicaid, the health program for the poor, was in full gear, and every hospital had a devoted individual as well as a devoted computer program designed to make sure every poor person that walked in that door got signed up for Medicaid within seconds. And so once the financial mechanism was in place, they rolled out this new marketing program which targeted the poor blacks in roach-infested houses who were getting asthma from the dander of the roaches. Now, because I live in a ghetto, I can tell you that actually my practice is in a ghetto too, is what happened also in the 80s and 90s, there's this transition, they built a lot of trash-burning plants and toxic waste plants in black and poor neighborhoods. So, of course, these kids developed incredible types of allergy and asthma-type problems. And by blaming it on the roaches, it pretty much excused the environmental toxins that were being imported into the neighborhood and dumped with, of course, no input, no say-so from the residents. So that was very interesting, the asthma thing. Now, another diagnosis in medical school, which was absolutely fascinating, was the diagnosis of alcoholism. And my background is I come from a family where mom had two drinks a year and dad had absolutely no drinks at all. He was a teetotaler, a non-drinker. And so all I knew was two drinks a year was pretty much about the limit of any decent person. That was my reference point, so I didn't know anything else. So I come to medical school, and so we're talking about alcoholism. What is alcoholism? And alcoholism is drinking enough alcohol, so it interferes with your responsibilities, and alcoholism is continuing to drink even though the alcohol is having damaging effects on your life. So, again, for us kids in our 20s, that's a pretty vague definition. So, of course, hands went up. well, how many drinks a day is a problem? And so we were told, well, if you're a white male executive with a lot of stress, then four highballs, that would be like gin and tonic or vodka and whatever, would be perfectly okay. But if you're just, you know, a regular Joe without much responsibilities, whatever, no, it could be just one drink a day would be enough to be alcoholic. And so the way they put it was, if you were from low socioeconomic status, then probably one drink would be enough for you to be alcoholic. And if you were, you know, higher social status, such as a white male executive, then, of course, four hard drinks a day would be just about right. So this, to me, was really amazing. So this means, then, if you're a white male, I'm not sure how much your income would have to be, but let's just pick a number, some income, and you're drinking four drinks a day, and maybe you have a slight elevation of your liver enzymes, and the doctor's noticing a slight tremor, the doctor would say, oh, well, you're a white male, and you have this income level, so it can't possibly be alcoholism. Let's do some more tests to see what else it might be. On the other hand, if you're a person of low socioeconomic status, and in medical school they made it very clear, low socioeconomic status meant basically black, I mean dark skin, and you had one or two drinks a day, then you would be referred for alcohol counseling and possibly a treatment program. And so this is really interesting how race is actually entwined in the medical definition. And it turns out, in terms of one's health, the person drinking four hard drinks a day and having a tremor and elevated liver enzymes is actually at higher risk, because what the doctor's going to do is dismiss alcohol as a cause and do a whole bevy of life-threatening, expensive exams to explain these symptoms. Whereas, of course, with the poor, low socioeconomic status person, he's going to end up, of course, just having his whole employment record trashed and having to write in his employment record that he was in alcohol treatment or that it was recommended. Either way, it's just not good and it's not pretty. And the unfortunate thing, too, is that alcohol intake is simply a consequence, again, of B vitamin deficiencies. And so if you give an alcoholic B vitamins, then he can take it upon himself to taper off his consumption. There's a lot going on here in the chat room. They're really talking a lot about this. Now, another area in medical school, which is really very troubling, very, very disturbing, is with pregnant women. And if you have a pregnant woman in front of you, if this is a black woman who's pregnant, then she would have to be a hooker who happened to get pregnant in line of work or line of duty, and the man that's with her, who says he's her husband, is most likely her pimp, or maybe her John if she got him to come with her. And this is a really, really debilitating notion to plant in the minds of doctors when it comes to caring for patients. And so then what's going to happen is you have this black woman who's pregnant. So if this black woman is pregnant, she's a prostitute, then of course she's going to have a sexually transmitted disease. So you do all these tests for sexually transmitted diseases. And then if the disease test is ambiguous, of course it was really positive. So now you're going to tell this lady that she has a sexually transmitted disease, that if she was white, you wouldn't even tell her she had, because the test is ambiguous and, you know, it's probably just a false positive, repeat the test, and it'll be okay. But no, she's black. So you know that in the course of her job as a prostitute, she probably got pregnant and picked up a few things too, of course. And so you're going to do what? You're going to interpret the test as positive, tell her it's positive, destroy her relationship with her husband, and then give her some antibiotics just in case the test is positive. Of course, the antibiotics destroy her immune system and the immune system of the baby she's carrying, and gets to be a very dangerous situation. And what are you going to have? You're going to have a compromised baby, a compromised pregnancy, a compromised mother, and a compromised marriage, and a compromised family. Absolutely devastating. Totally, totally devastating. And this is what doctors are trained to do. And then we're also taught in medical school, like, well, okay, this lady's pregnant, you know, she's a prostitute, her husband's a John, or worse, you know, he's the one that's selling her. And what is she likely to be carrying in her belly? It's a boy or it's a girl, right? So I would think. Wrong answer. The correct answer was a criminal. So this lady is in her belly is giving birth to the next generation of criminals. And therefore, we as doctors, even though she's giving birth to the next generation of criminals, have an obligation to find it in our heart to provide the standard of care. Now, we've talked about the standard of care for some time, so we know what that means. And so this is another area where the race of the patient can literally determine therapy and even determine outcome in a very damaging way. So that's one area of racist medicine. Another area of racist medicine, this is very interesting. If we're learning about rare diseases, like Addison's disease, for example, Addison's disease is basically a collapse of the adrenal gland where it's not doing what it's supposed to be doing. And so in Addison's disease, people have pigmentation throughout their body on their mucous membranes. So we were taught that if a person has coloration on their mucous membranes, pigment coloration, then if they have a low social economic status, in other words, I don't know if I said African-American or not. This one class was very interesting because it occurred to me that a person was just poor, white, and lived in a trailer, they could determine that having pigment in their mucous membranes would be normal. And so we were told that Addison's disease could be diagnosed by looking at the mucous membrane and seeing pigment in mucous membranes. And so obviously, if you have a poor white person who has pigment in their mucous membranes, this person is not going to be diagnosed with Addison's disease because, of course, the doctor was trained that only blacks have this disease. Or if a person is white, let's say, and has a job and they're employed, the doctor could deduce that their social status and economic status was not low enough to cause Addison's disease. So these are the things that happen racially and literally guide people into deadly diagnoses, deadly interventions, and deadly therapy. So I want to mention also that people should visit vitalitycapsules.com/May 2014 and sign up for my webinar. I'm going to talk about how to get results in healing your exact issue in less time than it takes to get a bunch of tests and sweat the results, and how to make your healing happen faster. And people can call in for questions at 914-338-0695. Okay. So we now have diagnoses based in large part on race, and it's really a tragedy. None of these diseases are racial diseases. Now, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day. He says, but Dr. Daniels, what about like sickle cell anemia? Well, white people do have sickle cell anemia. That's right. And white people even have sickle cell trait. And so this is a situation where people are being misled by the medical marketers to think that these diseases are racial when actually they're not. There's even the doctors will tell you if you press them, you know, is there evidence that these things are racial? Or really, what is the evidence? And the doctors will actually tell you that they don't know the evidence, that they got this educational something or other in their inbox. As we talked about in a few episodes prior, is that people or that doctors are receiving marketing messages in their inbox under the guise of continuing medical education or keeping up with the latest medical news, when really they're simply getting spin placed before them by the highest bidder or the highest payer. So people should call 914-338-0695 if they have questions. And I want to talk about next week's show, which is really interesting. It's The Art of Picking a Murderer. So next week, I'm going to talk about my experience as a member of the Medical School Admissions Committee, and I'm going to share the criteria for admissions to medical school and how these standards assure that your doctor will be dangerous. Okay. All right, so we have some questions here in the chat room. Let us handle one. What is the cause and course of action for vitiligo, and are whites and blacks with this condition treated differently? The whites and blacks for this, for vitiligo, actually treated very similarly. What they now do is sell them very expensive makeup, basically. And they write them a prescription for the makeup, so that means that their, you know, doctor or their health insurance will pay for the prescription. There is no cure for vitiligo in the standard medical whatever. And they throw a lot of pills at them, but there is no cure for it. Naturally speaking, it appears related to parasites that are eating the pigment cells and depigmenting the cells. And estrogen, turpentine, and high-dose B vitamins has been very helpful to people in the past. So I've treated people when I was in practice in the 90s. It's slow going, but they see their skin filling in and the color filling in, and they're absolutely really excited because, of course, the vitiligo isn't worsening, and the part that is white is filling in a nice brown color. But it's exactly the same disease for blacks and for whites. Okay, we have a caller here. Okay, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have tons of questions, but I'll limit it, of course. But and I also want to thank you so much for putting all this information out. I started using the turpentine over a month ago, and I thought I had candida, or however you pronounce it, candidiasis or whatever. But I noticed that the symptoms definitely dissipated, you know, just the I felt as though I, you know, when I had too much sugar or starches that I was getting, you know, starting to get a bladder infection. And, you know, I've eaten those same things again, and after the, you know, taking the turpentine, that didn't happen. You know, I do have a good amount of energy. But anyway, I just wanted to thank you for that. And then and I've spread that to many people, and hopefully they decide to do it. But my question is, I'm doing some research on distilled water, and I'm seeing all this conflicting information about distilled water is not good for you. It'll make your hair fall out and all these other, it's going to leach minerals. And then I see where it's helped so many other people. And I've been drinking it for the last couple years. And I have to say my hair has thinned and it's fallen out, but I thought it was related to the candida. But anyway, so what is your view on distilled water and the inorganic, organic minerals and that?
Okay, I'll answer that. Well, first of all, there is no one water good for all people, all times, and all whatever. So distilled water is extremely powerful in terms of its cleansing abilities. And so if you are having a crisis where you have, let's say, either chronic fatigue or aches and pains all over your body, everything falling apart syndrome, then distilled water definitely will help. And a lot of people, especially people who are overweight, they can tolerate distilled water because they have a huge reservoir of minerals throughout their body with all this excess flesh that they have. And so that's one thing. So distilled water, if a person needs to be cleaned out, yes. Distilled water, though, I always recommend they take minerals. Inorganic, organic minerals, I don't really get into that. I just get into, like, what works. And I've noticed that colloidal minerals with trace minerals work very well. So if you're taking a preparation that does not have trace minerals, you know it has trace minerals and has at least 70 different minerals in it, then you're pretty much wasting your time in terms of long-term healing. So you've got to take a look at that and get your trace minerals. We have a lot of action. Okay. The chat room says bone broth, yes. Bone broth is helpful. However, I have found that it doesn't seem to cover all 74 trace minerals. In other words, these animals seem to be able to get through life without all their trace minerals. So you really do need to get a trace mineral mix. Bone broth might get you 68 of those minerals, but it could be those missing six, the 74 trace minerals, that are causing your misery. And missing even one trace mineral can make really a world of difference. Now, I have a husband who eats everything. He eats noodles and cheese, you name it. And he has a little bit of arthritis and one little hip there. And so I had tried absolutely everything. Of course, we'd been slipping bone broth into whatever. And I finally broke down and bought some trace minerals. I gave him 2 tablespoons, and boom. It took about 30 seconds. All of a sudden, the pain in his joint was gone. So you cannot underestimate the power of trace minerals. And if you're doing everything right, so you think, it's worth taking a look at trace minerals. Okay. Okay, so this person comments that people are so happy that they're finally getting the health care they feel they deserve when actually they're setting themselves up for their own murder. And that appears to be the case. If we look at Medicare, where the Inspector General of Medicare admits to 18,000 people every month being murdered in the Medicare program, we can expect the same thing from any other government-run program, I would think. So it's really important to ask yourself, what is it that you want? Do you want to just steal money from your neighbor, or do you want to be healthier? If you want to be healthier, then engaging the medical system is not a reasonable strategy. Another comment in the chat room. So the medical industry is institutionalized racism. Yes, it is institutionalized racism. The other issue, though, and again, I think this is so important for people to understand, is it plays upon your racist views about yourself. So let's say you say, well, I am a white male, and I believe that because I'm white male, certain things are true. It doesn't even matter what your list is. But if you believe that because you're a white male, certain things are true, then that leaves an open door for the advertisers to simply go in and redefine your list of what it means to be white male. And then, so if you have that kind of space in your brain that this is what white men do, for example, then the advertisers walk right in that door, rearrange your list for you, and before you know it, you're lining up for lab tests and all kinds of murderous therapies. So you need to realize that it's institutionalized racism, but it's institutionalized racism of the individual exercising racist views against himself. It's really turning your racist beliefs against you. So that's an important thing to sort out. Okay, so let's take a look at our callers. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah, I have a question. I actually have been trying to get in contact with somebody there in your organization because I was supposed to have received my Vitality capsules.
Oh, what's your last name?
Muhammad, Muhammad. And I was told that I was supposed to have received them last week, and I couldn't
yes.
get that. And also I was supposed to have been part of, I think it was, what did you do, like a webinar?
Oh, it's not here yet. It's this coming Saturday.
Okay. No, there was something that you had on the 25th or the 24th of last week, and it was I don't even remember the name that you guys called it, but it was supposed to have been everyone listening and talking about turpentine and the vitality capsules.
Oh,
how
no.
to enhance.
I didn't have that. I had those. There's three episodes of those, and those will be emailed to you. So send another email to support.
Yeah, that was it. It was three episodes. Yeah, it was three episodes.
Right.
And I didn't even get that. So I was like, what's going on? I mean, should I, you know, so I had called and emailed. I've been emailing you guys for like the past like 2 weeks, and I haven't gotten anything.
So
I think it was Gabrielle.
Give me your first name.
Okay, my first name is Daiya. It's spelled D as in dollar, A A I Y A H.
Mm.
Yeah, and my last name
Daiya.
Is that Muhammad.
Is that the way you spell it in your you spell it in your emails that way?
No, in my email is D as in dollar executive office. At Yahoo.
Okay. Well, let me look for that.
Okay.
I have your phone number here, so I can call you back, too.
Okay, great, yeah. But I wanted, I wanted information on how to take the turpentine. I was actually promised the link and everything, so I'm kind of,
yeah,
you know, have
I'll
my backup.
I'll send that to you.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Bye. Okay. Uh-oh. I have to keep all these screens going at the same time. All right, so, listeners, support at vitalitycapsules.com. That's the place. Okay, that would be the place to get information. We've had a little bit of transition in our emails. And so, but I will definitely get back to her and handle that. Okay, so we're talking about racism in medicine. Now, I'd like to say also, the nursery is an incredible place where we have a lot of racism going on. I won't talk about the doctor side of it, but instead I'll talk about the marketing side for women and for pregnant women. Way back when, this was 1965. In 1965, the Medicaid program, and that's a program to provide medical care for women and children, so pregnant women and children. And so what happened was the medical profession sold the government on the proposition that poor women needed care. They needed health care in order to have healthy babies because poor babies were being born, well, sick. And this sickness among poor babies was somehow creating a burden for the country as a whole. Now, way back when, 60s and before, many babies were still being born at home. And especially if you were well-to-do or wealthy, you would simply have a midwife come to your home and develop and deliver your baby. Everybody was actually pretty happy with that. That went very well. And so, of course, in everybody's minds, they were thinking, well, for poor women who can't afford to have someone come to the house and deliver their baby, okay, they can go to the hospital. And so this was the initial marketing of prenatal care. So apparently it sold pretty well, well enough to pass the Medicaid program. So that was 1965. In 1975, it then became the obligation of a caring middle-class woman to get checked and get prenatal care. So 65, 75. And in 85, failure of getting prenatal care was somehow connected with having unhealthy babies. And what then happened was it became a compulsory thing where every woman had to get prenatal care. And if she didn't get prenatal care, then there was, of course, this peer pressure. But even worse than the peer pressure was this pretense for intervention by Child Protective Services because this woman did not consume a medical service called prenatal care, which has absolutely no scientific evidence of being effective. In fact, just the opposite. So when they marketed this, again, this was in the 90s, it was marketed as single women with brown skin having unhealthy babies were somehow bringing down or destroying our nation. And so in the 90s, I was a single black woman who was pregnant. I guess you could say I was wealthy. And so people would stop me on the street and say, well, I hope you're getting prenatal care. I hope you're not going to make us all look bad. And it was really annoying. And it became like a police state where people were actually policing themselves into getting this deadly care. And unfortunately, I did get prenatal care for that particular pregnancy, and it was an absolute, total, complete disaster with one medical-induced calamity after another nearly cost me my life. And that's what gave me the courage to have my third baby at home, basically unattended. I say basically unattended because I had a friend who was a nurse, another friend who was a doctor who were there, but neither one had ever delivered a baby. And so what has happened then with the prenatal drum roll is women are being socially pressured by their peers, you know, their family and relatives to get prenatal care. We've given police powers to Child Protective to intimidate any woman who refuses to have prenatal care. And we have overwhelming preponderance of the evidence that getting prenatal care and having a hospital delivery increases a woman's chance of death fivefold. So this is a case, because of the racial picture, you know, women who don't get prenatal care are single, they're poor, they're black, and their children are criminals. I mean, even a white person looking at that would have to say, oh, my God, I don't want to give birth to that. So we have then a stampede of women rushing into prenatal care, and we have a situation where we have autism at an all-time high, and the amount, the frequency of autism is proportional to the income of the parents. In other words, the parents' ability to consume prenatal and medical care correlates very well with the child's chances of being autistic. And so we have, in this case, because of this racial profiling, that anyone who doesn't get prenatal care, anyone who doesn't get proper medical attention for themselves and their child is poor, is ignorant, is a criminal, and has brown skin, of course. So these types of pictures, you have to immunize yourself against them. You have to not respond to them. And the only way to not respond to them is to banish in your mind the belief that any medical condition is in any way associated with a person's skin color or with their race. If you believe that at all, then these marketers, honest to God, they reach right in there into your brain, push that button, turn that switch, and before you know it, you're submitting to this outrageously dangerous care. So we have 90 seconds, and I'd like to remind you that you should visit vitalitycapsules.com/May 2014 and sign up for my webinar, How to Get Results Healing Your Exact Issue in Less Time Than It Takes to Get a Bunch of Tests and Sweat the Results. Okay. We are off the air, and I will see you next week, and you'll learn how to pick a murderer. Make believe.